Good morning, everybody.
It has been a long morning for many of us. We've been up since bright and early at the section meetings. It's good to see some familiar faces, too, in the audience. I want to acknowledge Dr. Joyce Crothy, my colleague, who's in the audience, who's a great colleague, mentor, and partner in crime on this project, and so she may have comments afterwards. So we're going to talk a little bit about the preparation clinically for crisis response, and the vector we're going to do that through is a particular pilot study we ran, but there's a broader, I think, message about the science of clinical nursing preparedness for emergencies that I hope resonates through the presentation. If it doesn't, why, we'll make sure it does at the end. We have nothing to disclose. We've yet to figure out a way to make money doing this. So we begin with the assumption, sort of a priori, that the world really is a dangerous place, and for many reasons, overpopulation, the destruction of our natural environment, we're seeing a much more calamitous impact from emergency events. These are not to say they're occurring more frequently, which is actually not true. I think we tend to say that, you know, notionally, that disasters seem to be happening more often. The truth is that that's not the case. The difference is the built environment and our ability to reduce the risk is substantially degraded. And so the impact of these disasters around the globe is far more severe. You can certainly talk to the many island nations that are seeing their potential existence end as a result of these sort of things. So, but it is dangerous. And here are some examples. I do disaster research for what I do, and so you have to include pictures of disasters so that people know what we're talking about. But this will be the last picture, I think, of a disaster you'll see. The other really important issue is that hospitals aren't immune from disaster events, and in fact, the opposite is true because of the way hospitals market, pick videos or commercials with the nurses with halos sort of backlit softly from behind, and we tell you, everyone, come to the hospital, it's where it's safe. Of course, hospitals aren't safe. They're one of the most dangerous places in the world. But then you come there, and during an emergency, of course, people bring their parakeets and their parents, both, some who are sick and some who aren't. And then we've seen a huge number of hospitals actually be hit by tornadoes. These are just from 2007 to 2013, hospital systems destroyed by tornadic activity or straight-line wind. So again, just to point out that we don't have an inherent resilience in hospital facilities per se, and in fact it's the opposite. Many of our libraries are actually far more resilient because many of them were built during the Cold War and include really robust bomb shelters, which many are sealed off now. But anyway, it just goes to point out we tell people to come to the hospital and not to the library, which actually may be a metaphor for our entire healthcare system. Here are examples of two hospitals on the right and on the left, of course, from Joplin, Missouri, where there was substantial damage. So nurses are really fairly critical, it turns out, in disaster response. And I guess that seems like that goes without saying, but the truth is that it's something we actually don't talk about because we assume that what nurses will do is put on vests and participate in like sort of incident command stuff in hospitals. And the fact is that actually that isn't what we know clinicians do in disasters. Yet that is how we train them still in most of our schools of nursing as well as in the community. But it turns out what nurses actually do, along with medicine and other colleagues, is actually take care of sick and injured people. And the whole point of the disaster care system is to deliver these patients to definitive care in a tiered way, ending up usually at a trauma center where nurses are providing some degree of care. Oftentimes nurses are also, because there are a lot of nurses in the world, driving around on the interstate and coming across all sorts of mass casualty events. A joke we always tell our students is that they get their nursing license, they're so happy to have it, they hang their stethoscope on their rearview mirror to signal to everyone that they are in fact a nurse, and they are driving and they come across a big car wreck and the first thing they do is come out and count respirations or something silly. Or maybe ask about your psychosocial status, right? Because they're simply not trained, in many cases, to do the really tough, gruesome work of first response. That isn't how we train nurses. It's not bad. It's not a problem. It's just sort of a reality. But our profession was born out of crisis. This is what we do. We are crisis people. We've sort of been deprogrammed over the years. So here is a first example, right? Who's this? Yeah, it's Flo, right? And Flo, while not looking happy in this photo, she was an expert in crisis, right? Among many other things, including epidemiology, as those of you, we all know that, as public health folks. Here in America, during the Civil War, we had who was our crisis nurse? Yeah, Clara Barton, right? Who looks a lot more likely like you'd want to have a beer with her, maybe reflecting sort of the American sentiment. But look, yes, we are a profession that was born out of crisis. And along the way, we have really lost our genetic predisposition to be agile in the face of clinical danger. And a lot of that's really good, and it's been born out of the safety movement, highly protocolized care in hospitals. I'm all for that, especially if I'm in a hospital. So this is not a judgment issue. This is more just a sort of an unintended consequence. And here are some problems that we've seen. Now, I'm going to get into, this will make sense in a minute, but there are some problems with our preparation of nurses in disaster since Flo. Namely, that we usually focus on government-sponsored curricula for emergency preparedness, which tend to focus on the incident command system and what hospitals may do, what nurses may do in that structure in a hospital. It's not to say that's bad. It may be necessary, but it is certainly not sufficient, and that's a key issue. We traditionally teach emergency management as a lecture in community health classes by people who really aren't experts in emergency management. Now, that's sort of heresy in the nursing academy, so for those of you in nursing schools know that one of the things you're expected to do in a nursing school is be able to teach anything. So if they came to me and they said, oh, you should teach OB, I should theoretically be able to do that. I think that's crazy talk. But that is a normative expectation. Because disasters don't happen that often, and because we are a risk-averse community, we tend not to provide authentic clinical experiences for nursing students in crisis. And if we do, they would primarily be focused on the sort of things I've already talked about. So sheltering operations, working in the incident command system, volunteering through social service agencies. And now usually that's a sense of immediacy and pacing, right? Because victims occur quickly and maybe students won't be there. We may have students in an ED or another setting, obviously, in clinical rotations where they could have the opportunity to care for these sorts of patients, but it's infrequent. I've heard it described as ethically inappropriate for nursing students to participate in these sort of environments. Obviously, you'll find out in a minute I disagree with that. When we do undertake simulation, and there's actually quite a lot of work in the United States around using disaster simulation, there's been a fairly decent body of literature on this, it tends to be focused on hospital and slow-going situations, or the opposite. Godzilla comes, everyone dies, and the lessons learned really aren't that applicable because the only lesson you learned is you better hope you're not there if that ever happened in real life. But the truth is, as I said earlier, which is these mass casualty incidents or MCIs or disasters or whatever really require first and foremost agile clinical response. And this agility, it turns out, is really complex. Are any of you ED folks or you work in emergency departments? So ED nurses are really, and physicians are really, the poster children of clinical agility. That isn't to say that they're the poster children for everything. They have a lot of other problems, ADHD, alcoholism, to name a few. But they are very successful and agile clinicians. They can move very, very quickly. It is sort of the exact opposite of what we would envision in an ICU environment, which may be high pace and fast, but is really deliberate. I mean, the ICU is really designed as a place to calm and slow down, right? We're slowing down and controlling processes, the exact opposite in a disaster. So one of the things we know, and this is, I had a lot of free time, I think, but we really need to re-MacGyver the nursing workforce and figure out how we balance this need for safety, right? Because what we don't want are people deviating from evidence. We want people to follow safety protocols, right? Until they have to suddenly change. And then we want them to somehow still be able to be like MacGyver, and for those of you who don't remember, you know, make a bomb out of a toothpick and a piece of gum or whatever. The problem is these are really hard things to maintain an equal balance in your head. So these are really tricky things. Take, for example, the fact that a lot of our students can no longer manually work IV sets. They simply aren't allowed to anyway, so teaching them doesn't make a lot of sense. Same thing with multi-dose drug vials. Many of those don't exist in very many places and very many environments anymore. And so having people do the math that's required to do them quickly. But of course, in an emergency when there are no pumps, when you may have to use bulk drugs, the expectation is that we're going to be prepared to do those things. So it's a real challenge to figure out how we teach people these things, but then say, but don't ever do this, right? Or if you've been in a hospital with electronic health records, which most facilities have some sort of EHR, and it goes down, you can see this shift. Some of the older, more experienced nurses are thankful the thing is finally broken. They can go back to paper. And some of the younger nurses who don't even know how to use a pen are forced to write. And, of course, it's really stressful and traumatic, and we know that's also when a lot of errors occur. So we developed a pilot intervention. It's really a pilot of a pilot, and I'll explain why in a minute, to figure out how we could simulate and provide some real training in what is the research suggests is the most critical nursing function in a crisis, which is triage, whether it's on the highway, after a bus accident, or in a slower, larger disaster. We partnered with the Mesh Coalition, which is a nonprofit healthcare emergency management organization in the city that coordinates a lot of public health and hospital response, to develop this simulation. And we took senior-level students from the community health nursing course that both Joyce and I are involved with at our Bloomington campus. We had them go through some initial START triage training. How many of you are familiar with the START triage method? It's one of several. There's START, there's SALT, there's probably others. The Israelis have a really nice one, sick or not sick, which is my favorite. It doesn't really matter because we weren't actually teaching them START. I mean, we did, but the point was to actually prep clinical agility, right? The START was just the vehicle we used. So we had them take an online course that was developed by the Indiana Department of Homeland Security. Your state has one, I guarantee it. Because this was all through federal funding, so your state Homeland Security Department, Health Department probably has some sort of online class in triage. We had them take this on their own to get some familiarity. And then we took them down to the Miskatonic Urban Training Center, which is a facility that we're very happy and fortunate to have in Indiana. It is operated by the Department of Defense and is used to train special operators who are going to be forward deployed around the world. I have some pictures. And then we provided this opportunity for our students to do nothing but go to this environment and do nothing but triage people all day long. Drill, 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 drill. Same thing over and over and over in a rapid cycle succession. Over and over and over and over again. Building muscle memory, we hoped, and giving them a chance to triage a ton of people in a very short amount of time. Again, not a disaster drill. No one put on vests. We didn't role play. It was simply taking our students to an unfamiliar clinical environment and running them through a skill, much like you might teach them how to drop a tube or start an IV, but again, teaching them this triage skill. Of course, we mixed it up quite a bit. This is Miskatonic. It's a roughly 1,000-acre facility. It used to be the site of a developmental hospital in the state. It looks kind of like a war zone, and it's by design. The parking garage has collapsed in on itself, and you think, oh my gosh, what a wreck, until the hydraulics put it back together, because it's designed to train people to do collapsed building rescue. There is all the mobile homes from here in New Orleans after the flood were shipped to Indiana and were set up in a village, which can then be flooded, a reservoir that actually can be flooded so that divers can go in and practice. I mean, it's a very sophisticated place. It's got hardwired video and audio everywhere, so you can monitor it. And so we were lucky enough to be able to use this. It also includes the only subway in the state of Indiana, which is a non-working train underground that we got from Chicago, an L train, ironically. And here's the intervention. We took basic triage scenarios. They were written on little pieces of paper, and it would describe the situation for the patient victim. You know, you've been struck by a piece of steel or whatever it is. And then we put them in groups. And the groups would be in a location on the ground and would rapid cycle as both victims and rescuers. Now, a lot of times we do a lot of team stuff, right? I mean, we love team stuff in nursing. We intentionally got away from that. Sometimes we had teams of two, and that would be it. Sometimes we used one person with you know, up to however many victims we could, again, to simulate more realistic environment. And then we rapidly cycled through so that they ended up triaging about 60 people. They would triage for literally minutes, that's it, 3 minutes, 4 minutes tops. We would stop, we would do a check of accuracy, and then coaches, faculty members who came down with us would do a quick rep debrief right there. So it was all just in time learning. What did you do? What did you miss? What happened? If you're interested, I can tell you more about the triage categories themselves, but suffice it to say that some of the more nuanced categories were the most difficult. So people that, you know, really needed immediate attention, but we wouldn't classify as red, right, that were slightly more nuanced. So mostly distal perfusion issues. this is the star triage scenario they learned. We literally showed them this in the morning. We showed them this slide and said, memorize it. And they looked at it and went, oh my gosh, you know, they're nursing students, so they got very nervous, you know. And then we basically took it down and said, don't worry about it, you'll be fine. And they were. So, which I'll tell you about in a second. Suffice it to say, these were triage tags they used. Here were our scenarios. We had one which victims out in the open with all the lights on, very nice and convenient, maybe something like this. Some we turned all the lights off and gave them flashlights. Very hard to use your hands when you have to hold a flashlight. They learned what tricks to do there. The other we gave them some headlamps in a rubble pile. And then finally in the subway cars with a huge amount of noise and no lights, we had emergency spotters looking at the gaps between the trains. A very, very intense environment, actually. We used an interprofessional cadre from the Indiana University School of Medicine, the Indianapolis EMS system, and the IU School of Nursing, who volunteered to come down. This is the nice part about our campus. We've got a wonderful group of folks who work together, and because we also run the medicine fellowship, we had some ready labor. They had a nice time. Everyone likes. Here's some of our students in the subway. You'll notice that there's this moulage on them, but it's not makeup. In fact, we actually do not use moulage. There's really no evidence that it works. Or that it helps people make better triage decisions, but this was a little sticker, like a piece of gel that you could just throw on. You'll see a patient tagged, one of our students. It was cold, by the way, when we did the pilot. We told them we didn't care. We told them to wear bad clothes, get on the ground. They loved it. They were a little nervous at first. We put them on a bus at 6 in the morning from Indiana University Bloomington. You know, took an hour drive to this place. They had no idea what they were going to do. We didn't tell them anything on purpose. They knew they were going for training, but they had a really good time. You can see, again, the students were very good. By having the students be the victims, which was one of our intentional approaches, it allowed us to do a couple of things. One is to sensitize the students to feelings of isolation and loneliness, which are actually reported to be quite common in MCIs from patients who have non-life-threatening injuries, but also to give them a chance to give feedback to their colleagues about what worked and what didn't. Interestingly, there's usually a couple students in every group where you have to say, hey, you're not Shakespeare, let's tone it down, you know. After a couple of these scenarios, the students get great respect for the horror and tragedy of these events. They take it very seriously. They just do an exceptional job. Here are some lessons learned. Everyone loved it. I don't think we had a negative response. There was appropriate stress during the event. That was the idea. They were very scared, and they were afraid of making mistakes. That's not going to come as a surprise to those of you who work with nurses. Fear of error is a very common thing, I think. And we knew that we had to do some additional research. This whole idea for this came out of a series of conversations I had with colleagues at Columbia University in Georgia around the implementation of stress inoculation in high-fidelity simulation. We tend to think of simulation as a safe space, and I know that that's a common refrain. We want to make things safe for our students so that they feel safe. And in fact, what we were trying to do here is make it feel unsafe. We wanted to understand what it was like to be in a highly stressed environment. There's a ton of research. I've spared you the citations. I'm happy to send them to you, largely out of the military, about how to apply stress inoculation in student situations in a positive way as opposed to a negative way. But again, it's rapid cycling is one way of doing it, giving people a comfort with visual patterns that don't make a lot of sense, right? Like a corpse on a subway. That is something that our brains have trouble processing, and we know exposure really is the big way. So there's some additional research. We are in the middle of a randomized prospective controlled trial looking at students who undergo high-fidelity stress inoculation versus traditional instruction to see what the uptake and performance rates are on triage in a simulated high-fidelity stressed environment. And we're also applying, we have another study going on right now using Google Glass to provide just-in-time triage application for students through a wearable device to see about uptake. So we know that there's some work to be done. We've got our information here. Happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you very much.
Great presentations today, and what I'd like you to do is, as you decide you're going to ask questions, please identify which group you want to speak to, and they will go from there. Any questions? Okay. Then we'll end. and we will, you'll have 5 minutes to talk to us if you don't want to talk in front of the group. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.